Hi, I'm Terry Meekan. Welcome to It's Our Business. It's Our Business are documentaries which get under the hood of companies and people to find out who they are, what they do, and how they do it. Smith's Gloucester Limited was formed in 1982 by Alan Smith, and it's grown to be the largest waste management company in Gloucestershire and surrounding counties. Smith's has a number of operating divisions: transport, skip hire, plant hire, asbestos, construction, demolition, laser levelling. But one of their major operations is the processing of recycled waste from both households and businesses. And that's where we start this documentary, at the old Morton Valance airfield in Eastington. I met with operational manager Peter Jukes and site manager Ian Watson, who gave me an insight into how waste is processed and what happens to it after it leaves your home. Ian, I believe that there's five different areas here for the processing and disposal of waste. Could you just talk me through what they are? There's a transfer shed over there. What's the transfer shed do?
As you can see in front of you, there's a weighbridge and a site office. Everybody that comes into the site must report to that area. From that area, they get diverted to a different department in the site.
Depending on the load?
Yes. Where we're sat at the moment is the general waste area. The mixed loads of waste get tipped within this area. If it is clean cardboard or stray district council or mixed recyclers, it will get tipped within the transfer shed, which is right in front of you over there. If it's wood, it will be tipped in the wood area, which is just behind the shed, and again the aggregate, which is a little bit further on from that. As we go round the yard, you will see the different departments and what it actually does. All the processing equipment is running today, so today is a really good day to see what we actually do.
We're now in the transfer shed, and it's split into quite a large area here. What have we got inside the transfer shed here then, Ian?
This is the transfer reception, where all the waste, or the mixed loads of waste, get tipped. The main excavator in front of you, the lorries will come in, the men in front of you are the banksmen of the area. They will guide the lorries back to tip the mixed loads in front of the excavator. That excavator will remove the recyclable material from the load. So that could be metal, cardboard, A-grade wood, which is pallets and packaging material, and C-grade wood, which is all other wood, plasterboard, mixed rigid plastic.
So it's called a transfer shed because you're transferring it from the lorry and you're splitting it into the different materials inside the shed.
Yes.
Right, okay.
He would also then remove the non-recyclable material to go into the landfill pile, which you see just to the right. That is the material which we can't do anything with currently.
What's the proportion of stuff that comes through the doors that has to go into landfill as opposed to being able to be recycled?
It's usually around 15% goes back out to landfill.
Right, okay. What happens to it from the transfer shed when it's been stacked into the different piles? Where does it go from there?
Once it's been separated into the skips, the forklifts will actually take it to the department where that material will be recycled. On site here, we either bale it, shred it, crush it, or screen it.
So from the point of view of people who actually buy into the recycling environment, which is most householders nowadays, it's a big help to you, the fact that it's already pre-sorted by the time it comes here to some extent.
It helps us a great deal because we can actually direct deliver it to the area where it will be processed. It will go through a basic checking procedure on site, but it does speed up the process for us.
Walking around the site with Ian, I can tell you that recycling actually does work. The contents of those green boxes that you put outside your house every fortnight for collection do end up here, and they are segregated into streams of material and sent off to manufacturers for recycling and rebuilding and new products. But the 15% that goes to landfill is obviously a problem. So I asked Peter Jukes, the operational manager here, what plans there were to make use of this material in the future. He told me that there was a whole new generation of waste-to-energy plants being built throughout the UK, and the landfill material would go there instead of into the ground. However, will there be enough to go around?
Where it gets exciting in the next couple of years, it depends whether you're a gambler or not. In the UK, there's it's something like 96 or 104, something like that. Energy from waste plants either had planning approved or in the determination process in that an application has been submitted. When all these plants come online, there's only a finite amount of waste in UK PLC. There's going to be a big battle on for attracting that waste. If we look at where we are currently, geographically wise, Avonmouth has recently, or Viridor Avonmouth has recently had the planning approval for 450,000 ton plant. That's energy from waste. Viridor at Ardley, which is West Oxford, so that's this side, easily commutable, is a similar size, 400,000 tons. Viridor Cardiff at Splott, they've got another 300,000 ton plant machine. You've got Javelin Park that will take about 230,000 tons, which it will have a bit of commercial material, it'll have to make it financially stack up. And then you've got Kidderminster, which is only sort of like west of Worcester, that's got approval for a 450,000 ton plant. Well, you're close to just over 2 million tons worth of rubbish. Okay.
Demand.
Within Gloucestershire. Mm.
So
well,
maybe there's not enough raw material to satisfy all these plants.
Well, where it will go is we pay now, I'm not putting money on it, I would do if I could spare the money, where they'll pay for the waste. Either that or it will be neutral at the gate fee. And another thing that will come in the background of it, because these plants will need feeding, because there's so much capital employed to get them off the ground, I believe landfill mining will be the next.
You think they'll start digging the landfill
up?
Yeah. That's interesting. That's very interesting.
They're all cleaned up. And, you know, the amount of plastics and woods and bits and pieces that are in there that will be used as fuel.
So a brand new industry.
It'd be massive, yeah.
So effectively, all the seagulls at Hempstead have to find a new home by the time it's
ready. Well, I hope so, because they're just as nuisance to me as they are to you. They're blinking.
That's really interesting, that. So, I mean, even though the price might be neutral at the gate for the materials, you still, from what you've just described, got more plants being built than you've actually got, unless you start to go to landfill mining.
Could be.
So in your vision, then, what timescale are we looking at?
I think probably within the next 3 to 5 years. The plants that are in the pipeline are going to take 2 to 3 years anyway. Mm. I mean, one of the ones that Corey's got the planning approval for, while they're in the process of building, is it called Belvedere? I can't remember, it's West London. It's enormous. Mm. It's massive. We look at the place.
And that's to feed energy back into the grid? Or
oh, yes, that'll take energy back into the grid. Because the other thing as well, we need alternatives for fossil fuel. I don't see gas as being an issue in years to come. I think there'll be plenty of gas. But oil could be interesting.
So you heard it here first. Electricity from landfill material. Landfill mining. Maybe we'll see Hempstead Dump finally raised after all. You're listening to Stroud FM, and this is Terry Meakin with Stroud's in Business, where this week I'm at Smith's Industrial Waste Management Section at Eastington. After the revelations about land mining being a new industry, Peter also told me about the inefficiencies he felt there was in physically collecting food waste from households and transporting them miles on trucks to dumps.
When we talk about food waste collections, everybody gets really excited about it. You know, let's collect food waste, well great, but there's some considerations there. You have to make a plastic bin for it. In fact, you have to have two plastic bins. One's the little one that's in the kitchen, and one's the other one that's outside. So, you know, whatever that costs, you know, environmentally wise, I don't know, but there's a cost. And then there's a special truck to collect it, and the truck drives around, it picks everybody else's, you know, food waste there. We look at Severn Trent, they can cope with liquefied food. That's what these digestion plants do. That's what's in the blinking toilet, at the risk of being very blame. For the sake of, you know, £85 of one of these, you know, liquidisers in your kitchen sink, all the food waste could be managed. You wouldn't need the trucks, you wouldn't need the bins, and you wouldn't have all the hassle of people getting upset about having a fortnightly collection because they've got food rotting in the bin.
Who's insisting upon it?
It's politics. It must be politics. There's parts of Droitwich that do it, and there are some councils that fund the liquidisers.
Well, they'd be better to subsidise the liquidisers than...
Where I'm sat 100%. 100%. I know every house can't accept a liquidiser as they're currently manufactured, but there must be some way around. The amount of householders who look in you look at in the UK. But I don't know why they don't do that. But Severn Trent has, you know, not just Severn Trent, Wessex Water, they've all got the same technology for managing with the sewage.
So, there you have it from the professionals. Food disposal can be done in your own home with a liquidiser. No need to have it transported on trucks and in boxes.
We've now walked over to another area of the plant where I can actually see a conveyor belt which is actually dropping stones and bricks and similar material into bays beneath them. What's that area called, Ian?
This is what we call the plant, or the MRF, the Material Recycling Facility. This is the machine which deals with all the soil, the hardcore and the rubbish from the front reception area, known as the trommel waste material. It gets fed into the conveyor belt, it comes up through, it goes through the trommels.
What's a trommel?
A trommel is basically like a big sieve. It sieves it down into different grades of material, so it can be either blown or sucked or picked.
And what have we got coming out? We've got large bricks, I can see, and further back we've got some soil, I presume, and smaller materials?
This material is what we call the oversized hardcore material. It goes through the trommel. In the trommel we've got 75mm punch plate holes in the steel, so everything 75mm and below would actually fall through. This material is the 75mm plus. It comes off the back of the trommel, goes past the blower and then past a picking station and then comes out clean.
So that material there is used for what, rebuilding roads or crushed?
This material would be picked up by the loading shovel, which has just come around the corner now. You would pick that material up and take it into the back area to be mixed with the other hardcore to make the crushed hardcore at the back.
And the other stuff that is falling off before it gets to this stage, the smaller stuff, where does that go?
The smaller stuff goes further down the plant. It also goes through a secondary trommel, so that would remove the soil from the hardcore. The soil would be taken off to the rear of the plant, and the mid-sized material would be going past blowers and suction units again, and it would clean up, so the smaller hardcore will come off clean.
And that has to be, that goes to a cell, that doesn't go to landfill, where does that go? That's recycled for building works or what?
Yeah, both of those hardcore materials get taken into the rear of the yard to be crushed.
Oh, I see. So why bother to separate the large from the small then, if it's going to be crushed?
Because we want to take the large lumps out, because we don't want to go further on down the process to damage any of the plant.
So it's simply, it's not the fact that it's an end product in itself. Both that and the intermediate stuff is going to be crushed. You just feel that it needs to come out at this particular stage.
Yeah. It gets fed through. The trommel is quite a heavy-duty trommel, so we want to take that material out straight away, just in case there was any further damage. But there's no need to actually put that through the whole of the system. If we can get it out quite soon, it's better all around.
You've got all these different materials which are recycled. You've got metal, you've got plastic, you've got cardboard, and I know it varies by volume, but you know, which attracts the best price at the moment? Is it the plastic because of the oil content?
Plastic seems to go up and down quite a bit, like most of the commodities. I would say one of the best at the moment is cardboard.
Is it? You think cardboard would be in abundance and wouldn't have a premium? I wonder why that is.
Yeah, cardboard just seems to be more stable of the price.
Interesting. Well, I'm off to see the boss now, Ian. And I'd like to thank you and Peter for the time you've given me this morning. It's going to take me about 15 minutes to drive up to Eastington. So in the meantime, perhaps you give me a choice of music and we'll play that while I'm on the road.
I'd like to have Katie Maliwa, 9 Million Bicycles.
It's a thing we can't deny, like the fact that I will love you till No one can ever say it's true, but I know that I will always be with you. I'm warm by the fire of your love every day. So don't call me a liar, just believe everything that I say. There are 6 billion people in the world, more or less, and it makes me feel quite small. But you're the one I love the most of all. Of the love that you give me every night. There are 9 million bicycles in Beijing. That's a fact. It's a thing we can't deny. Like the fact that I will love you till I die. And there are 9 million bicycles. You know that I will love you till I die.
And here I am at Eastington, where I'm going in to see Pamela Broomfield Smith, the company secretary, and her brother and founder of the company, Alan Smith. I started off by asking Pam if she thought that people actually knew what Smiths did.
I think it's quite strange that the number of people that actually see Smiths, I mean, we've been around for over 20 years, but actually don't know what we do.
I then asked Pam what were the main earners in the different divisions.
That's quite a difficult one because each one of them has its own different balance and they are quite interlinked. So, for instance, if our construction division is very, very busy, and the demolition division, then our plant hire division will be busy as well. Several years ago, we chose to split the divisions into their component parts, put a divisional manager in at the head of it, and try to get them to increase external turnover so that we weren't all so reliant on our construction or demolition division winning work. And that worked quite well.
Where do you see the major opportunities and maybe the major threats over the next 12 months coming from?
Well, as I said, the major threat has got to be coming from the financial world, the stability of the banks, digging ourselves out of the, not Smiths personally, but the country, the debt situation, and the global economy, and it's still far from stable.
That's great, Pam. Thanks very much for your overview on that. I'll pop in and see Alan now and get his view on what it's like to be the top of a £40 million company. While I'm hunting around the site trying to find him, we'll play a bit of music. What would you like?
I'd like Bon Jovi, Living on a Prayer, please. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Strode's in Business on Strode FM 107.9. I'm Terry Meekin, where this week I'm visiting Smiths of Gloucester, down at Eastington.
Right, I'm in with Alan Smith now, the man behind the whole of the operation, the man who founded the company back in 1982, Alan?
Somewhere around there, yeah.
Right, and what were you doing before 1982?
I went to work on a farm when I left school, which I always sort of had farming in my heart, really. And I'd done 84 hours for £12.50, I think, in my first week, and I thought there's not a lot of future in this. So I'd done that for about 12 months, and then I went on to Fit Milking Parlour. So I went from £12.50 for 70 hours to, I think it was something like £45 for 40 hours. So
Was this in Eastington, was it?
No, it was actually in Nimpsfield. I was brought up in Nimpsfield.
Right. So how old were you then?
16, 17, 18.
Yeah. So in the farming stroke industry and allied industries. And then when did Smiths as a company actually start under your own name?
Yeah, we started, I probably started as A.R. Smith originally with just one machine. A friend of mine and his father-in-law started a business laying electric cables in and around the South Gloucestershire area. So I took off there. And
so you just felt that if you bought a machine or borrowed a machine or hired a machine and then subsetted it up, that would bring some income in?
That was sort of my first actually major step, really. I did initially start a company with my brother-in-law doing agricultural contracting, but we decided to part company after 12 or 18 months, and then I went on my own then.
So that division that you started back in 1982, is that still a distinct division within Smiths at the moment?
We still run my own an A.R. Smith account, but it doesn't. It's like a dormant business at the moment.
But the plant hire, is that where the plant hire division
came
from?
Yes, that's where the plant hire originated from, yeah.
So we started off with a JCB and some early one-man band contracts back in 1982, and then where was the evolution from that? What was the next?
It was just actually saying yes to everything, really.
But more still in the plant hire line?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I started by myself, and then Mervyn, God rest his soul, who died so 4 or 5 months ago, he started with me. He used to work for the water boards. Then we had two JCBs, and we'd work all day and all night if we had to. And just moved on from there, really. Just kept working hard.
So that took you from 1982 to where?
Probably 1982 to 1990, probably, I suppose.
So that was a one-division company until 1990?
Yeah, around that.
And how many people employed by 1990?
We probably got up to 8 to 10, I suppose, by then. Maybe a few more. I was still quite a very small, very high controlled it from, from our house.
In Eastington?
Yeah, I was still with mother at the time at Nimpsfield, yeah.
So, we cut to 1990, so we get to 1990, and then, what, this big mental explosion that you're going to take the world over, or did you just actually decide again to, another opportunity came along and evolved?
It's just driven by pure hard work, really. You know, there's no real science to it. We've just we had a lot of good people come to work for me, people that wanted to work for me or work for the company. We just really would not say no to anything. I remember Merv's first week when he said to me, "I've done more miles in this JCB than I've done in my car in the last month." You'll just take it on anything you possibly can.
But we're still back in 1990 with a plant, what we called a plant hire division. I mean, when did you start to actually segment into these different leaflets that we've got here? I mean, what was the next sort of readily identifiable division that you could tell customers we're now into this rather than just plant hire?
Yeah, we sort of started to split the divisions up when it began to grow into separate divisions. We had a HBR transport, and it was over the initials of my family. Mm-hmm. And Boosmore Construction, who again is a dormant company. In that transition period between 1990 and 2000 is when we formed Smiths Gloucester to sort of thrust it all back together, really.
So what's the major obstacles on that you, should we take over this? I mean, what have been the bigger, has it been financing? Is it staffing?
Yeah, mainly. I mean, as staffing hasn't been so bad. I mean, I think a few milestones, which we'll probably come on to a bit later on. I mean, I was lucky. I had a lot of good friends that came and worked for me, a lot of people that I made friends after they worked for me. And we had a lot of loyalty, you know, which was trust and loyalty go such a long way when you're either building a business or trying to run a business, really. It didn't feel like people, you know, were trying to run amok with me. It was a nice time.
And do these people still stay with you now?
A lot of them are our managers. You know, I think that was one of the things that I've probably have been guilty of in the time that I've run a business, is to try and take people too far when sometimes their capabilities haven't been worthy of that, really.
Well, I suppose you've got a vision and you're expecting everybody else to have the vision, but if everybody else had the vision, they'd all have £50 million companies and you'd be working for them.
So. Well, maybe. I would not know that's such a bad thing, but I don't know. I struggle to write down in words what actually drives it. It's the ethos of getting up early every morning and doing as much as you can in that single day to do exactly the same again the following day. And that sounds a little bit naive and bizarre, but you know, I think whether you're working for yourself or working for other people, you know, it's what I think a lot of people miss. I think it's quite significant because everybody was self-employed with me when I first started. We probably had 4 or 5 people that were self-employed, and then the government sort of changed their ethos on self-employed schemes. And it was amazing to watch people that were self-employed and thinking for themselves, thinking that if they didn't work that week, they wouldn't get paid the following week, you know, and to watch that transition to go from PAYE, from a self-employed to PAYE was quite immense, really. You could just see people slacking off their intensity, you know, which was quite bizarre for me, really, because the same person, one week he was employed, self-employed, next week he was employed, and it was as if the impetus had gone out of them, you know, as to that single internal drive that they would have.
But they do say one of the major obstacles in a company growing is for the founders, who, you know, are there every day on the wheel, to actually be broad enough and big enough to be able to say, right, I'm paying these guys, I'm delegating these guys, they're going to make some mistakes and they can't all think the way I do. Do you still find it difficult to delegate it out, or do you say, I'll keep my eye on it, but I won't jump in every 5 minutes?
Not the size it is now. I mean, there's a lot of key people that run our business. Paul, who runs a demolition business, hasn't worked anywhere else. He's 40-ish. I can't remember what he is now. And he's been a family friend all his life and has worked for us all his life. So I don't struggle with that. No two of us are the same. I think everybody's opinion is valid, and I think that you have to let, if you're going to ask somebody to manage anything of yours or anybody else's, they need to manage it in their own way, not in yours, because that's not fair. Yes, you can massage it and manipulate it a little bit, but it's not fair to constantly undermine people, I don't believe.
And what about not staff benefits as much, but obviously, you know, people work, if they want to work for you all their life and they don't actually have a share in the company, although maybe you do have a shareholding scheme for employees, I mean, are there pension schemes and things like that? I mean, how do you...
Not really. We've asked them to sort of... What my philosophy have always been is that if we pay those guys enough, they'll look after themselves properly. And we haven't got too involved with pension schemes. It's funny, actually, we were just about to get involved with a lot of... personal healthcare and things like that when the recession actually hit this time, because we have got, like as I say, a lot of key people in key areas, and financially, if you can make that work, that's brilliant. Unfortunately, with financial cramp and things like that, that's the sort of thing that goes by the board when things aren't going so well.
So what's the leverage like in the company? I mean, are you able to expand from funds accumulated, or are you still... You know, is there still a lot of debt, if you like, to actually...
It's a bit of both, really. I mean, we're such an expanse of a company. Anything from, you know, we're expanding the farming side at the moment purely through contracts driven by Sainsbury's, constantly updating, constantly expanding in areas where we can.
When you say updating the farming side, I mean, this is the first time that someone's shown a farming side at me. What's the farming side? I don't see it in any of the leaflets anywhere. is this a tax haven somewhere down in Eastington?
No, I don't. Perhaps a tax man would like to think that, but no, it's not. It's just some land. I originally bought some land at Nimpsfield, which is where I was brought up when I worked on there as a boy. Has gradually tacked on pieces of land to it to form quite a substantial area now. And like everything else, I try and drive it the best I can. And on the way, it's turned it, that in itself has turned into quite a substantial business now.
So where do you think going to take in the company in the future? Just keeping it, keeping your head down till the recession's gone, or you know, what do you want to do, either in another division or another direction? You know, what's your strategic vision?
That's a difficult one. I mean, it's really the first. I mean, we came through two recessions. If you think about it, through, you know, the '70s and eighties and nineties. I actually started the business in a recession, so I'm not frightened of it at all. I think what frightened me more this time was the volume of people. There are people here that weren't my rock solid, you know, backbone, that you know, lost their job for whatever reason. And that's the bit that I struggled with. But the one thing that was good for me, and you know, Pamela and myself done our rounds in the course of a week to touch every single person that worked in the company, and to actually look at my original guys in the eyes and see their strength, that was fantastic for me. And to have to let the other guys go was like a victim. I felt a victim of circumstance. You know, it was a sign. It wasn't my fault. It was a sign of the times. It was where, you know, the economy in the country was, where the global economy was, and you know, I think it probably was healthy for us at the end of the day. It actually, I think we were over trading at the time. We were flying along on a crest of a wave which probably wasn't there, and it made us stand up straight. So that, you know, I think the actual recession was good, was a good thing for Smith.
But I have heard within the company that you've got some visions for new businesses developing, or you think they will develop, and perhaps you'd like to be part of them. I mean, landfill mining, I think, is something which you've got high in your mind. Can you sort of fill us in a bit on that?
I think, you know, for me, what is a massive plus for me is not from what I create. I think as you get a bit older, I'm 53 next week or whatever it is, and I don't care what anybody says, as you get older, your enthusiasm does tend to wane a little bit. And for me, it's not from where I can drive it, it's from where the people, A, the people that work here, and B, my direct family can actually drive it as well now. But like landfill mining, I, like Pam has said, you know, I see that coming in the future, where we just landfill, mass landfill all the time. And I can see all these power plants being developed and put up, and I can actually see a shortage of material to drive them eventually.
So do you get involved on the political side of these sort of developments? Because obviously if you've got contacts and a network of people that are considering these, I know, but regulatory bodies and things like that, you know, I mean, or do you just say, well, I'll see what they do, and then I'll adapt when they've done it, you know?
I don't really. I frustrate with governing bodies. I think there's so much bureaucracy and I'm not going to say the other thing that goes with that, but I have this vision very often, and you know, things like councils, we've been taking the council's curbside collection, and people can beat that up for what it is. I personally feel they do a great job, because they actually sort their waste at source, and that is the only way. We fell out, we've got a depot in Tewkesbury, we fell out with Tewkesbury Council, because I said the Stroud Council are doing this right. They started it, and they went back to mixed recycle it. Well, that means that someone, somewhere, has to pay for it to be recycled then, because someone has to handle it. Whereas with Stroud, it may look a bit tedious, but believe me, and you know, I think this is probably one, from a waste point of view, it's the one most frustrating thing, that we've been doing this for now, it's still a young business, and we've been doing it for 20 years. We've made those mistakes. We've made some goddamn awful mistakes doing some of it that we have, but nobody really learns from the mistakes that we've done, because they go down their own road and they don't seem to want to listen, do they?
Well, I mean, Peter was saying about the stupidity, I suppose I would call it, of taking food waste away on trucks, when he felt that an £85 liquidiser in homes and in houses would do the same thing.
Yeah. I've got a different view on food waste, because we run a few pigs on the farm which has started from nothing. I got given five, and we probably run about 300 pigs now, because, you know, that for me is the food waste thing. You know, it's never a waste. There's no, there is not, there isn't such a thing as a waste. It's, it's,
it can be reused and recycled through pigs, etc.
Yeah.
But okay. So, but he's thinking, I think, perhaps of maybe the waste could be used as energy if it goes that liquidising route rather than transported. I mean, there's pigs to feed, but not everybody's got a load of pigs. So, 85% of the stuff is coming out the door.
I think, you know, for me, we're just a terrible, terrible wasteful nation, and being part of being involved with these supermarkets, we've touched Sainsbury's quite strongly, and you know, what they class as waste, just because it's gone by a sell-by date, would feed thousands and thousands of starving people in the world, and I find that absolutely bizarre how we can actually throw food away that is more than capable of feeding starving. You know, we're quite happy to sit in our lounges eating our supper, watching these starving people in Ethiopia and wherever, when there's hundreds and hundreds of tons of food being thrown away in our own backyard.
Which landfill site does your stuff get shipped out to?
All sorts, really. We probably run a sort of 50-mile radius of Moreton Valence as our main hub. We use Gloucester, Bishop's Cleeve, Bristol. Depends where our backloads are going to, really.
And you've got some, I think, if I got it right, Peter was saying that there's some export, some materials going to export to feed energy plants on the continent.
Yeah, that's all evolving almost weekly. RDF, they call it refuse-derived fuel, which is what we see. At the moment, we pay £85 a tonne to take it to landfill. They're still looking upon that as a gate fee, but I see that you know, when it's put into a fuel, which is only a very, very brief shredding operation, it then becomes a combustible fuel to drive power plants.
So have you got a shredding operation that can actually do that and ship it out of here as a ready-to-burn material?
Yes.
You have. And is that being exported at the moment?
No.
It's not?
The problem that we've got is they haven't bridged the gap enough. We pay £85 a tonne, roughly, to tip it in the landfill, and they want us to ship it to a dock and still pay £65 a tonne for the privilege, and we've also got a process in front of that as well, you see, so the gap isn't enough.
So it's not economical at the moment?
Not just at the moment, but it will come. When the plants come online in this country and the transport's taken out of it and people will start to scream for more and more of that material, the whole thing will spin on its head, I believe.
I mean, you've got bulk and you've got transport and you've got the canal. I suppose there's no way you can tie any of that together. Is there any destinations that you can put your stuff on?
It'd be great, you know. I'd love to go back to the old canal days and punt off down the river and take 3 weeks to get to Bristol and things like that. That'd be fantastic, wouldn't it? But, I mean, it's all about time, you know. Our life is so fast that it doesn't wait for us. That's the trouble.
It says in your in-house magazine, and you won an award for Family Business of the Year, that you highlighted in applying for this award that your strong links with the community. So what are these links? I mean, is there an Alan Smith playing field or an Alan Smith award in Arthur? Where are these links?
We used to have a Smith's Way at Forest Green, but that's gone by the board. I don't quite know what's happened there. I just need to interrogate that. But, yeah, we do get involved. Like our sort of emblem for a sport, we do get involved with a lot of a lot of sports ends of it. We do a lot of sports pitches. We've been involved with a local community centre at Easington, the local schools. We try and do what we can. Sometimes it's only something as little as a skip for their fate. Sometimes it's as much as a donation or a form of help with the construction side. So, you know, we do as much as we can. Unfortunately, with times like they are, we're probably not doing as quite as much as we were. But I'd like to think we can, you know, we actually push that side of it probably as well as we possibly could.
Well, I think if you've got a company this size, which is you know, which is this important in the community, even just from an employment point of view, and not many people see it visible, if you do get the chance, like you're saying, to put the effort into community centres or fields or whatever, I think it does pay itself back, and I think, you know, it would find its way into the hearts of people in the community. That was in the canoe. It's called the canoe because I understand people say, paddle your, don't trust anybody. Paddle your own canoe is one of your philosophies.
Love a lot and trust a few. I think you always have to trust. I do trust a lot of people, but it was a saying that when I was actually sorting the skips myself, I found an old phrase book, so that's where that saying actually came from. Love a lot, trust a few, but always paddle your own canoe.
So you don't, no plans for retirement yet then? You keep going about this 53rd birthday and...
you know, no retreat, no surrender, I think they call it.
So what would you, to round off, Rena, I suppose, there'll be people listening out there, there'll be youngsters and that, and I mean, it all depends on character, a lot of things, but what would, sort of advice would you give to people starting out, maybe not youngsters, maybe people that have been forced into taking a different view onto employment? What would you say are the main things that... the main personal characteristics that one's, in your experience anyway, has had to have in order to succeed?
I think if you take no and can't out of your vocabulary, you'd be three parts of the way there. I've just driven this business to where, it, never in my wildest dreams did I think I'd ever get it this far. I got it this far with a lot of really great people, and just by saying yes, I'll do whatever I can. And sometimes it has worked and worked really well. Other times it hasn't worked so well. But you've actually tried your best. And I think that's a little bit of where our society has gone wrong. We, you know, there's too many people that are happy to stay at home and work off of some form of benefit with no apparent future, which is quite scary for me. You know, I've been driven by being able to supply for my family. I've been petrified at times when I haven't had the money to, you know, work for the groceries and things like that for Anne, and you know, my wife has been brilliant through all this. She's always been really supportive. So if there's two things, it would be the just drive and an inspiration to get up to actually supply your family with their needs for that week, month, year. That's probably the biggest and most thing that's driven me to where we are now, really.
What we like to do is ask our interviewees for a choice of music. So, Alan, what choice of music have you got?
The one that really sticks in my mind is Valerie.
Valerie by Amy Winehouse. little bird told me you've not only diversified into all these different divisions, but you've got a racing team now. Can you tell us a bit about that, please?
Well, I think I was railroaded into it one way or another. We've a local rider again from Brimscombe, Dan Cooper, was riding in the BSB British Superbikes, and started supporting Dan in a small way, probably two, three years ago. His support fell completely apart with the business going bankrupt, and we picked him and his bike up and ran with it for the rest of the season. Rebecca, my daughter, and myself enjoyed it so much that we decided to form our own race team. We competed on Triumphs, which we went for the Triumph badge because it was British, and hopefully there's a chance we're one of three that will be put forward for Triumphs British supported team for next year. So
is this road racing, is this scrambling, is it
this is road racing,
it is. On a track,
it competes in all the big tracks, Silverstone, Brands Hatch, all the big tracks. There's 12 round series. It's quite a big, it's covered on Eurosport on Sky. We get the whole of the Sunday afternoon on Euro 2 on a track day, basically.
So, do you brand the rider's uniform or the bike itself?
Yeah, it's all branded in the Smiths brand. It's quite nice, really. We've got a lot of support within our business and the companies that we deal with. We still manage to brand the bike with the Smiths brand, and it looks very smart, if I say so myself.
So where's the engineering work take place for bringing these machines up to race standard?
A lot of the engineering is taking place in the Midlands, but we've actually got a small workshop at home now where we fettle the bikes into race form, and got some good mechanics around that, and have a lot of fun at the weekends, really.
So how do you gain an edge in motorcycle racing over competitors? I mean, what do you have to do to a bike to actually get it to win?
I think it's we're constantly trying to find horsepower, trying to find that, like as you say, that tiny edge. We're looking for hundreds of seconds to win races, and we're banging on the door now. We've had 5 podiums this year.
Before you sponsored the team, have you been into bikes yourself? Or
was it motocross man myself, but there's a lot of people in road racing that were originally motocross. Yeah, I was scrambled around this area for years in the 80s and 90s.
Where's this guy live, the one who's the rider?
He's from Brimscombe.
Is it just a one man, or is there a team?
No, we run three guys. There's another guy from Swindon, Matt Whitman, and another guy, Luke Mossy, who's actually from Lincoln.
What's the size of these engines?
They're 675 Triumph. They run in a 600 class, but because the Triumph engine is a 3-cylinder as opposed to a 4-cylinder, they can run some extra horsepower. So,
when you say you've got the workshop up at the back at the base, back at the ranch, what can you do there? That
they just fettle them for. We could do very little engineering and things like that. That's all dealt with by a guy called John Trigger, who works and lives in the Midlands. He's got his own workshop there.
This was an archived documentary on Smiths Gloucester Limited, originally broadcast by Terry Meekin in 2012 on Stroud FM. You've been listening to It's Our Business by Terry Meekin. It's Our Business are documentaries which get under the hood of companies and people to find out who they are, what they do, and how they do it. To make the colour, depth, and detail of your business available 24/7 worldwide, contact terrymeekin.com. You can also visit www.terrymeekin.com, where you can hear and download more documentaries in the series.